Tropical Storm Irene caused more than $12 million in damage to Vermont. But the state hopes that the fall foliage season will bring much-needed tourism dollars from the annual influx of leaf peepers. A tourism official says 85% of Vermont was untouched, and weather forecasters say conditions are ripe to produce great color. Hardwick, Vermont is also open for business. The town was largely undamaged by the storm, and that's good news for foodies. Hardwick has become a kind of mecca for the local food movement. Famed TV chef Emeril Lagasse filmed there, and the town's been featured in the food section of the New York Times. Hardwick, population 3,200, was once famed for its granite. That ended in the 1920s when builders switched to concrete and the town fell on hard times. Behind the most recent boom are entrepreneurs growing local, sustainable, organic food. But often it's food that the locals can't afford, says Vermont farmer and freelance journalist Ben Hewitt. Hewitt has written about Hardwick, Vermont in the book The Town Food Saved, How One Community Found Vitality in Local Food, which was released in paperback earlier this year. We spoke to him when the book was first published and asked him to give us a picture of Hardwick, exactly where it is and what it looks like.
Hardwick is located in right at the gateway to the Northeast Kingdom, which is the most rural region in the rural state of Vermont. You know, it's got about a 1.5 block downtown with a slightly longer sort of business district. All the trimmings and fixings of a very sort of rural land-based economy. During the first few years of its operation, the Buffalo Mountain Food Co-op, which opened in 1975, operated in the same building as a gun shop and a liquor store. And I sort of like to call that, you know, one shop stopping Hardwick style. You could go into the same building and get your tofu, your Jim Beam, and your 357 Magnum.
You actually found that Hardwick's history, the social and civic infrastructure that it inherited, was crucial to what's happening today. So tell us what's happening today. This is the core, obviously, of your book.
You know, I was really became really struck about 4 or 5 years ago when I started to notice this incredible sort of growth and influx of small-scale ag-based businesses in the Hardwick area. And, you know, being a native Vermonter and having sort of grown up socialized to this idea that Hardwick was a sort of, you know, hard times town, I became really struck by what I saw as this kind of wonderful, delicious irony in the juxtaposition between this reputation and this notion that this was the town that was sort of, you know, being held up as a the savior of our food system and the, you know, this bastion of local food. I had always sort of been struck, you know, growing up in rural Vermont in a blue-collar community, it always had sort of seemed to me that the local food movement, you know, carried this sort of whiff of elitism and, you know, it was all about sort of organic free-range arugula and all these really high-end foods. And I just loved the notion that this town was perhaps the one that was going to, you know, show the rest of this country and perhaps even other countries, you know, how to create these localized food systems that are actually, you know, equitable and that work for everybody.
In fact, you made up a word for the people who are turning Hardwick around, the so-called saviors of the food system, as you say. You call them agripreneurs. Who are they and how did they transform Hardwick?
There's Tom Stearns. He operates, founded and operates a business called High Mowing Organic Seeds. There's Andrew Meyer. Andrew founded and owns two ag-based businesses in town. One is Vermont Soy, and the other is Vermont Natural Coatings, which takes whey from the cheese process, which would normally be a waste product, and turns it into environmentally friendly wood finishes. There is Pete Johnson, who operates Pete's Greens. They cultivate about 30 acres of certified organic vegetables.
Pete's the farmer hunk, as you call him.
Pete is the farmer hunk. And when Pete Johnson's name comes up, you see a lot of swooning among the female members of the audience. And there's Andy and Matteo Keeler. And they operate two distinct businesses, but both based around the production of artisanal cheese. They're all producing, you know, great products.
So there's a lot of good here, and you admire what these agripreneurs are doing up there, but you also see an irony. You're not really nourishing the region if you're selling, say, $20 hunk of cheese in a town where many people come home with a weekly paycheck of $300.
I think that's true. I mean, you know, one of the things that I thought about a lot was how do we want to look at these food systems? And yes, these goods are perhaps beyond the means of many of the people in the region. But I think there's also something to be said for the fact that they are creating jobs that, by and large, have been very resilient to the broader economic malaise in this country and are, you know, pretty pleasant jobs that pay pretty good wages. That said, you know, the ultimate measure of success in any localized food system will be, can it really be viable from a business perspective and also be feeding the local populace.
Well, exactly right, because you spoke with a lot of longtime residents there who really have mixed feelings about this movement or are really not even aware that it exists.
Yeah, that's true. And I think, you know, the agripreneurs are 30-somethings. They're young and ambitious. And, you know, a lot of the sort of longtime farmers in the region, I mean, I talked to dairy farmers. I talked to a couple in their 60s that runs a mobile slaughter business and has done this for decades. They really were pretty much completely unaware of what was going on. And some of the other people are, I think, just a little leery of this. And they see that, you know, for generations, their families have been quietly operating on a localized sort of barter/food economy. And I think they, for one, wonder what the heck all the fuss is about. And for another, perhaps feel a little bit threatened by the idea of Hardwick sort of being held up as the bastion of local food and are concerned by what might come with that. As these operations perhaps start to grow and need to expand their land base, and how might that threaten some of the farmers who have, you know, long been operating in the area on a much smaller or more quiet scale, I should say, and perhaps don't have the resources to sort of tie up some of those lands for themselves.
We're revisiting our conversation with farmer and freelance journalist Ben Hewitt about his book, The Town Food Saved, and about how the burgeoning local food scene brought celebrity to the hardscrabble town of Hardwick, Vermont, though longtime locals had mixed feelings about that blessing. When we spoke to Ben Hewitt last July, we pointed out that Hardwick isn't alone. Other communities have taken up the local food banner. I asked him to explain his research, what it taught him, and how to think about food and farming differently.
I went into this book thinking that we need to move toward these local food systems for all sorts of sort of negative reasons. You know, the industrial food system is predatory on our land base. It's predatory on our environment. It's not sustainable, et cetera. This is true, and we are going to have to figure out how to change the way we feed ourselves. But what I really came to was sort of this feeling of empowerment, I think, that comes from this. As a culture, we have basically outsourced every facet of our day-to-day well-being. You know, we get up in the morning and, you know, we slip into clothes that we don't have any idea how to make. We drive cars we don't know how to fix. We use computers that we know nothing about that come from very, very far away. And really, food is one of the few things that we really have the possibility and the potential to sort of do for ourselves. And I think there's an incredible sense of empowerment that comes from that.
We want to know more about what kind of model Hardwick brings to the rest of the country and the important question, what is the future of local farming that is sustainable? Is it possible to feed 300 million Americans that way?
The flip and easy answer is yes. The notion of sustainable agriculture in the context of a country of 300 and, you know, however many million people and growing, you know, all the time is a really nice notion. I guess I am a little bit dubious that it's really, really possible to have truly sustainable agriculture in that context. You know, I've sort of done away with the term sustainable. I think it's been co-opted by corporate interests who would like to sell you something that they want you to believe is sustainable. Mm-hmm. And I think that we, by and large, I'm not certain we know exactly what it means in the context of the sort of population and the systems that we have in place. So, I've, you know, in my own talking about agriculture, you know, and food, I really prefer to use the term restorative. And I guess by that, I mean, you know, we're looking at food systems that are, you know, restorative to our communities. They're restorative to the bodies in our communities through nutrition. They're restorative to our community's sort of vitality and vibrancy through, you know, economic opportunity, but also through that sort of sense of pride and self-reliance. And they're also restorative to the land base. I mean, this is one of the huge issues. I mean, this country was sort of blessed with an incredibly fertile land base that, you know, we've really almost done our best to sort of do away with. I mean, we're losing topsoil out of the breadbasket of this country at an unprecedented rate. And so, you know, it's not something we've really had to think about as a nation for a long time. But, you know, I think very soon we're going to need to – actually, I would say right now we need to start thinking about, you know, what does it mean to have fertile soils? How do we create, you know, a resource base out of our soils? I mean, that's just so far outside the context of most people's day-to-day thinking in, you know, 21st century America, and yet it's so incredibly vital to our well-being.
Tell us a little bit about your own story and about your own farm, because you fall between these two groups that you write about in your book, the longtime locals and the new agripreneurs, as you call them.
Well, I grew up in Vermont. I was born in the northwestern Vermont town of St. Albans into a sort of a dairy farming community. At the time I was born, there were over 4,000. In 1971, there were over 4,000 dairy farms in the state of Vermont. There are now about 1,000. Vermont has lost 10,000 of its 11,000 dairy farms since the state started keeping track in 1947. I was born into my folks into a one-room or two-room cabin, I guess, almost two rooms, room and a half maybe. And, you know, my folks were of that sort of back-to-the-land movement. You know, my dad was editing poetry anthologies and writing poetry and, you know, keeping a big garden. And we had no running water or electricity. And my mom was milking cows at a farm down the road. My wife and I, with our two sons, do operate a small farm. We have 40 acres, and we have cows for beef and milk. We do pigs and sheep and chickens and ducks. And my 8-year-old son, is raising turkeys this year. We endeavor to do a lot of barter and trade with our neighbors. We try to make sure that our food stays, you know, as close to home as possible. It's really important to us that it just sort of stays in our community. You know, that's we place a high value, I guess, on that sort of, you know, maintaining those relationships with our neighbors.
And so what's the biggest thing you've learned from living, working, and eating in Hardwick?
As you can tell by the title of my book, The Town That Food Saved, you know, I sort of came into this story with the notion that Hardwick was a town that needed saving. And I think part of that was just having grown up on its periphery and sort of being socialized to this idea that the town was really a hard times town. And, you know, to a certain extent, that's really true. I mean, the economic numbers sort of bear that out. But what those numbers don't do a very good job of is sort of, you know, describing the interconnectedness of the community and the way people look out for one another and are resourceful and able to sort of care for themselves. And I think we need to sort of figure out ways to sort of reimagine prosperity in this country. I mean, I think it's pretty clear that the notion simply building up, a huge retirement fund and, you know, having a bunch of equity in your house is not as certain as it might have seemed just a few years ago. And I think in terms of, you know, sort of enduring wealth, we could learn a lot, you know, from Hardwick, not only for what it's doing in terms of food, but also for what, you know, the community really is and how the community works. And, sort of ironically, I think a lot of what's happening in Hardwick is sort of happening not in spite of the fact that it's an economically disadvantaged region, but kind of because of it. And I guess, you know, by that I mean that when we have a lot of money, we basically have a safety net, and we are able to buy our way out of situations, or we are able to sort of distance ourselves from other people in our community. And when you don't have a lot of money, you really learn to rely on your friends and neighbors. And I think, you know, that a lot of what's happening in Hardwick, what's happened historically in Hardwick around agriculture, and what's happening now in Hardwick around agriculture, is really a product of the fact that it is a town that has struggled economically.
That's journalist and farmer Ben Hewitt. His book, The Town Food Saved, How One Community Found Vitality in Local Food, is now in paperback. Ben also has a new book. It's called Making Supper Safe, One Man's Quest to Learn the Truth About Food Safety.